Hello, I'm Nancy Brough, and I'm joined by Kim Brown, and we're Your Liver Lineup, updates and unfiltered insights. Thank you so much for joining our podcast. So Kim and I were both in Amsterdam for the European Liver Congress, and we're going to discuss some of the more impactful abstracts that were presented. Kim, I'm going to hand it off to you. I think that there's a lot of noise around fatty liver disease, which we now call metabolic dysfunction-associated steatotic liver disease, or MASLD, and it's a more detrimental form, metabolic-associated steatohepatitis, or MASH. So what did we learn about this?
So thanks, Nancy, and welcome everybody to our first real podcast. The first abstract that we thought was of interest was an abstract that was presented by Dr. Lumba. As you know, he's quite a star in the field of MASLD. But this is looking at a new molecule, FGF21, which they call efimosfermin alpha. And it's interesting in several ways because, as we know, FGF21 analogs have a variety of impacts, positive impacts in patients who have MASLD. They can modify glucose uptake, they can improve lipid metabolism, they can reduce weight, improve MASH. But one of the interesting things about the FGF21 molecules are their effects, and fairly quick effects, on fibrosis. So this was a study that was actually looking at fibrosis markers in a patient population who were undergoing treatment. It's an interesting molecule. It's given subcutaneously, and it's given once a month, so not something that patients have to take on a daily basis. But they looked at fibrosis markers. They included PRO-C3, PRO-C6, CTX3 collagen fragments, which is relates to fibrinolysis. And what they were looking at was to see how fast those markers might change in patients who were treated. This was a 24-week treatment period. And they also looked at the relationship between the fibrosis markers and those of fibrinolysis to look at whether those were changes. And the last thing they looked at was whether there was a difference between the patients who had more or less advanced disease, so the F2s and the F3s. And what they found was that very early on, so this was at week 4, the pro-fibrotic markers actually had a significant reduction as compared to baseline. And furthermore, when they looked at the relationship between the PRO-C3 and the CTX3 ratio, there was a significant change actually at all time points. So suggesting that there was improved fibrosis that started very early and was significantly different by week 24, and that there was a shift actually to fibrinolysis. So there was no difference between the F2 and the F3 patients. So it'll be interesting to see. This molecule seems to have pretty positive effects on the fibrosis, at least in the liver, and relatively quick. It's given once a month, so it'll be interesting to see, you know, further on how this pans out, particularly actually in those patients who have, I think, more advanced disease, even cirrhosis.
No, absolutely. I think it's really exciting to think that we have something that's an anti-fibrotic. I mean, most of our other medications that are either approved or we think are going to be approved for fatty liver disease are more addressing either metabolic effects that lead to steatosis accumulation or weight management, or the apolipid accumulation in the liver. And so I think that they're anti-fibrotic effects are probably a little more delayed, which would not be unusual if you're starting at a different point in the care cascade or the treatment cascade. Yeah. It also seems that if we get this agent or we get this class of agents, that they might have more pan-disease state applicability. If you can impact fibrosis from fatty liver disease or MASLD, you might also think that it would work in alcohol or another pro-fibrotic, state.
Yeah, I think, it's interesting, all of these molecules, different classes of drugs that are being used now for MASLD and the differing effects. And, it's interesting to think about whether in the future, when we have all of these available, whether we will better stratify patients as to which might work best given their clinical situation, whether they have more or less fibrosis, whether they have higher or lower weights, diabetes or no diabetes. So it'll be interesting to see how, you know, how we stratify patients and apply these therapies in the future.
Absolutely. And more classes, the better.
Yeah.
If you have someone that doesn't respond to one class, then it makes sense that you're going to be able to have an alternative to give them. Do we know the side effect profile? Is this pretty well tolerated?
So the class of drugs tends to be, it seems like all of these medications, the primary side effect profile is GI, but safety and tolerability seem to be good. As reported in the 24-week period. So so nothing that I've seen so far in terms of this class as a showstopper for side effect profile.
Well, that's great. And probably another good reason to not start all the classes at once if they all had GI side effects.
So, yeah.
I think one of the other things that we struggle with, the number one or two, however you task them, is alcohol-related liver disease. And although we've traditionally asked patients about their alcohol intake, and I would say that the vast majority of my patients are very honest. I mean, there's no reason to lie to your physician. You are either going to be doing a disservice into your treatment plan or, you know, we're going to be confused as to why you're not getting better. But we do have a number of biomarkers now that help us confirm a person's, you know, stated history or help monitor patients that we think are at risk for relapse or recidivism, especially around the transplant time. And I think there was a little data on this at EASL, right?
Yeah, this was actually a really interesting study that I think all of us probably have wanted to do, but haven't yet done. And this was really to correlate PETH testing with self-reported alcohol use. So I think this is a really important presentation in large part because when we risk stratify patients and, you know, as we've redefined now, MASLD, MET-ALD, and ALD based on alcohol consumption patterns, we have risk stratified patients into clinical trials, excluding those, right, with significant alcohol intake. But PETH testing has not been uniformly used in these clinical trials. So it's been a lot of self-reporting. So this was a study, quite a large study. It was single center, but looked at let me see how many patients, almost 3,000 patients. And they were distributed based on, you know, clinical information, based on VCTE. So they had to have, you know, greater than 8. They had to have a CAP score greater than 248. And then they had an audit C score that was also measured as well. So they were classified into MASLD, MET-ALD, or ALD based on that information. And then what they looked at was they looked at the correlation of PETH testing as it related both to the self-reported amount of alcohol consumption in the last week, but also the average over the subsequent weeks. And what they found, and it's not unexpected, I guess, that there was a very poor correlation, actually, with self-reported average alcohol intake in the population, and really only modest correlation with the very recent alcohol intake that over the last month. And about a third of the patients who were classified as MASLD actually had underestimated their alcohol intake and likely were misclassified, and so maybe could have fallen into that MET-ALD category. In fact, in the MASLD group, 8% of the patients had PETH testing greater than 200, which we would consider significant, and 31% of those patients had alcohol levels between 20 and 199. The majority of those did have them in the mid-range, but again, you know, should open our eyes to the fact that we now have confirmatory testing that can, I think, better categorize these patients. And again, thinking about how we risk stratify patients for clinical trials moving forward, it'll be important, especially as we have medications that can potentially affect MASLD, but also potentially affect alcohol use disorder, right? So again, important to understand where these patients actually are.
Now, Kim, we do a lot of PETH testing at our institution, especially in our peritransplant population. I don't know that we use it a lot in our patients that are not being considered for transplant. I know that I've occasionally talked to patients about getting it if, you know, we're engaged in lifestyle, but their disease doesn't respond, just to make sure we're not missing a co-founder. And there's significant variability in what a person can drink. Like, I don't know what you say, what you hear from your patients, but I'll have patients that are, you know, very heavy drinkers. They're like, they say, well, I never drink to get drunk. Do we know if PETH testing is, you know, kind of universal across a population, or is there variability? So maybe another way, if I have a patient who doesn't seem to have much effect from alcohol, will their PETH test be the same with the same amount of alcohol ingestion as someone who feels the effects faster?
You know, it's an interesting question. I would think that it would probably not correlate with with their report, and more correlate with their actual alcohol consumption. I could be wrong, but that's our assumption. Where we struggle sometimes are those patients who sit very close to 20, especially in our patients that are likely moving to transplant. We don't really know what that means. Was that a slip? Are they not recording? Where is that lower level or limit that we should consider? But I do think it should open our eyes. And quite honestly, I think all clinical trials now should be better characterizing their patients. And I think the more we utilize PETH, the more we'll understand, you know, how we can use it as a tool. But it's been a great tool for us in terms of our patient population moving toward transplant.
Absolutely. I think that familiarity is 90% of, you know, the battle. Once you get used to using something, you can better explain it to your patient. You can better interpret that data. And we have the same thing. We have patients that, you know, are very adamant that they have long-term abstinence, and then they'll have values that are very close to that detection level. And we struggle as a program.
Oh, the other place I was going to say we find it very useful is in our patients presenting as donors, because they, again, we take a self-reported, you know, account of how much alcohol they take. And then we will get a PETH and see, you know, in some cases it's reasonably high. And then, you know, we go back to them. It allows us to counsel them. Look, this is, you know, you're placing your liver at significant risk, right? In the absence of donation, we don't know the effects of taking a low bout with ongoing drinking. I mean, is it worse, better, or the same? I can't imagine it's better. But you know, we counsel them as well in terms of donation and safety of donation, but also safety for their own health. So you're right. We don't routinely use it in our patients who are not moving to transplant, but I think maybe we should, because again, it allows us better counseling for the patients.
Absolutely. So the next study I have to discuss is something called RETRACT-B, so that our hepatitis B population is constantly on a quest for cure. We have wonderful long-term maintenance therapies that are very good at suppression, but patients would love to know that they're cured of something, that they do not need to take a drug forever. There were presentations at EASL about our quest towards functional cure, and I think a lot of agents are interesting, but not necessarily the prime time yet. But one of the studies that is looking at a large database called RETRACT-B is looking at just withdrawing our typical nucleotide or nucleoside analogs in individuals who have had long-term suppression, and then meet metrics that allow us to, determine someone who might have a higher chance of success. Now, this is a long-term study, and there have been multiple presentations on this. You know, it currently has a little over 2,000 individuals. It is across multiple centers. And as we learn things, one of the first lessons in this study was that the amount of quantitative hepatitis B surface antigen, or quantitative surface antigen, predict success. So we don't have to reinvent the wheel. This study, again, this presentation, again, demonstrated that those that have low amounts of surface antigen had more success. But that was one of the early messages from this, to the point where, based on ethnicity, they do recommend not considering discontinuing a person who still has surface antigen unless the amount of surface antigen is less than 1,000 and probably less than 100 if you're Asian and less than, and other factors based on age and such. So this is now looking at 10 years of data in these 2,000 individuals. The cohort is a little bit, as you would expect, 81% Asian, 15% Caucasian, about 4% were Black or other. It's predominantly male, 72%. And of those that were treated with antiviral therapy, the majority received entecavir or tenofovir in the form of TDF or TAF, as we would expect, given the current standard of care. It did surprise me because 10% of the individuals do have cirrhosis, and we can talk about that. But in my cirrhotic patients, I typically do not try to stop therapy unless they are clearly going to have a strong case towards success, which usually means they've lost surface antigen and gained surface antibody, and then I still bite my nails. And then in this group, the cohort was not necessarily young, so that the mean age was 52, so that some, the range was quite broad. They had to have long-term suppression so that anyone who had active hepatitis B DNA was not going to be a candidate for discontinuation. And then they are reporting out another data cut. And so one of the things that is important is that they, again, show that flares are possible. So the amount of individuals that had a clinically significant flare, which included an ALT increase, was 29% after 5 years and 30% after 10. And in those, there were some episodes of decompensation. So a little over 50 patients decompensated. 35% had jaundice or ascites, encephalopathy or bleeding, and 41 or 2% actually died of related liver events or, liver cancer. So we wouldn't blame liver cancer on stopping therapy, at least at this point. But certainly if you had a decompensating event from recurrent or reactivation, that might not bode well. So the 10-year message is that there is continued off-treatment surface antigen loss. So it was 17%. So by no means everyone, that most of the individuals that stopped therapy that did not lose surface antigen did have to go through retreatment, so over half, and that surface antigen levels less than 100 really seemed to be the cutoff where most individuals could think about cessation of their nucleotide or nucleoside, but still some of those individuals had flare. And if you had quantitative surface antigen levels greater than 1,000, really functional cure was not a possibility where there was only a 6% hepatitis B surface antigen loss. So I'll turn to you, Kim. I am still very hesitant to stop antiviral therapy in a person who has not lost surface antigen. I know that quantitative surface antigen is a tool that we are increasingly becoming comfortable with. But I really just hesitate to stop my patients because I don't think that recurrence rates are very predictable. As you can see here, there was a 30%, clinically significant flare after 10 years, which means that you can't stop a patient after a year or two say, hey, you're great. We don't have to worry about this anymore. You still have to continually follow them.
Yeah. No, I found this to be very interesting, pretty supportive of all of the smaller studies that have been reported previously. What was interesting I found was that, because this was a multi-center, national trial, not everybody followed the same stopping rules, right? And so even though there was overall 17% chance of surface antigen clearance, if they followed the retract B criteria, which, as you had pointed out, less than 1,000 for Caucasians, less than 100 for Asians, Caucasians who had a surface antigen less than 1,000, they had a 56% chance of clearance. And those Asians with less than 100 had a 43% chance. So again, I think part of the confusion that we've had in the data analysis is actually following there haven't really been strict recommendations, right? And so people, I think, respond. I know I do. Would I try it? Usually not, unless somebody says, hey, I don't want to take this medication for the rest of my life, in which case we have a discussion. But again, I found it interesting that 10% of these people had cirrhosis. It's not something I would do in somebody with cirrhosis due to the risk of decompensation. And we saw decompensation in some of these patients. So I agree with you. I don't routinely do it. I'm hopeful that we will have, much better chance in the future having better therapies for functional cure.
Yeah. And I think to add to that, because there were not great consistency even on who got retreated, some patients got retreated at different thresholds than others. And so I think when you're looking at real world data and clinical variability in practitioners and patients, we're learning things from this, but it may not be a message that translates 100% to how you take care of the patient in front of you. So there was a lot of hype around primary biliary cholangitis. And so, Kim, I've been in practice a while. I know that I have several patients with primary biliary cholangitis, but this is still not my most common disease that I take care of. But there are new therapies for both PBC, which is primary biliary cholangitis, as well as cholestatic pruritus. And so there was quite a bit of buzz around this. One of the trials that was really looking at cholestatic pruritus in patients with primary biliary cholangitis, although you could assume that this might work in other cholestatic conditions, was an agent which is in the class of IBAT inhibitors, which stands for ileal bile acid transit inhibitor, which means it blocks where you absorb your bile acids in your ileum. This is looking at lenarnixibat, which improves cholestatic pruritus significantly. So this was the GLSEN trial. It was a phase 3 trial. It had about 119 individuals in the intervention arm and 119 in the placebo arm. And these were patients with PBC that had significant pruritus. This is not just the occasional itch. They had debilitating itching. And the goal was after 24 weeks to see if there was a change in the monthly itch score. And they also looked at some secondary endpoints as to how rapid the itch improved and whether it was sustained and whether this also impacted sleep-related interferons. And this was a success story. So that they showed that there was a significantly improved itch score. They used two different, the WINRS as well as the NRS, which is a numerical rating scale for itch. And they showed that the patients that had the intervention did much better than those that had placebo. They also showed that it occurred as early as 2 weeks and impacted sleep-related interference, which is exciting, and it was sustained. So we don't know if this is going to impact the disease state, but certainly in individuals who have that debilitating pruritus, you might help them sleep better, you might help them navigate life better with these IBAT inhibitors.
Yeah, I think this is great. You know, these are approved right now for Alagille's and PFIC, so they're out there. I actually have used them a couple of times for my post-transplant patients who have, our DCD donors get recurrent biliary strictures, so it's not PSC, but they have terrible pruritus, and we go through all of the medications. So I think having access to these for our patients with PBC, PSC, but also other patients with cholestatic issues and pruritus are going to be a real godsend for patients.
Absolutely. Also, I don't think that the serum level of bile acids is very predictive. So that although it might be useful to check that in a patient who's got significant pruritus who also is cholestatic, I don't think that the agent would not be effective if the bile acid level was low.
Yeah, no, I agree. I don't have that much experience with these medications yet, but I think I think we're all very hopeful that it's going to be one of the tools in our toolbox to help these patients symptomatically.
Yeah, absolutely. And as a reminder, they are not yet approved for cholestatic pruritus, really Alagille's and PFIC, like you pointed out, although we do hope that they gain approval soon.